White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Listeners and students of the International Jew, welcome to the 51st episode on this evening of June 13th, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And we are completing Chapter 45, Jewish Gamblers Corrupt American Baseball. And when we finish that, which we will begin Chapter 46, Jewish Degradation of American Baseball. You know, seeing the story of how the Jews move in and then first put what they're interested in on a more national scale, that's what it seems to me, like they did with theater and so on, and then they turn it into a gambling event or some way that they can, you know, make big money on it for certain people. And it's really sickening. It's just so sickening. You're reading this second chapter heading this on baseball. Really, I got so many ideas, but they're all pretty much the same ideas, you know, that these people have got to go. But then I also, through some of it, come to the realization that the ones that they call the dupes and the Gentiles who, you know, fall, put up the money, you know, do, you know, like all this stuff that's going on, that the mass of people love the colorful side of things and the kind of entertainment side. And that's why, you know, these people know it and they're good at it. Jews are good at entertainment and providing circuses. And I think about the ballpark, you know, you go to the ballpark, how much do you care about the sport of it? You're really going there for the fun and you get in there and there's a certain sounds and sights and so on. And then there's the food, you know, the hot dogs and, you know, the food vendors coming around and the soft drinks and the beer and the chili dogs or whatever and all that stuff, you know, that's all part of it. It's like a big, fun event. And, some people get more into their teams, but even that, they like to see some fun things going on amongst the players and so on. It's really too bad. We're not a more serious people. Most people are not more serious is what I say.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of people derive a temporary sense of identity and sense of purpose from rooting for their team. It's kind of a distraction from the basic emptiness of current American life.
Yeah, but then that seems pretty empty in itself.
And then that's been, excuse me.
Now where'd you go?
I had to sneeze. Spirit has overflowed into politics now, so that politics is nothing more than like a sporting event with a big exhibition quality to it. You look at a show like... Well, it's not on anymore, but Crossfire, which has a lot of imitators. You know, you have the liberal and the conservative basically shouting at each other.
Yeah.
That's what they do. They shout at each other.
Yeah.
And the viewers tune in and they root for their side. And when it's over, you don't really expect anybody's mind to be changed about anything, do you?
No, and you know, the people that produce that, They know that they're going to shout at each other. They're supposed to do that. I mean, it's all just set up like another. Yeah, I can't stand that stuff anymore. It's been a long time since I have watched it. But all right, well, we've got to get started here. We left off last week with talking about Rothstein,
yeah,
Arnold Rothstein, the Jewish big shot money gambler crook guy. And his relationship with this Attell fellow, And Tell is known as the fixer. So I don't know if you want to. We'll just let. I have more to say.
Abe Tell is a former boxer, Jew. Lots of Jews got into boxing because boxing is easy to fix. And he was involved in a plot to rig the World Series, apparently, and he was known as the Kingfish, or the King Bee of this conspiracy. But then it suggests that Abe Attell was really a scapegoat for bigger fish, meaning Arnold Rothstein. So, it says, Attell was the goat, the unanimity being rather startling. It has been known, of course, that men have been so deep in sin that they have been chosen to bear the sins also of their friends on promise that influence would be exerted, or on threat that if they didn't stand as goat, certain past indiscretions would be advertised. So he's suggesting that this Abe Attell may have been under coercion by the other Jews. Whatever Attell's case might have been, he stood the gaff. He was the scapegoat for the other Jews. Attell told the ball players that Rothstein was putting up the money. And Attell was never brought to book. It was even testified that Abe Attell was not Abe Attell at all. Certain monies lost in a bet had been repaid, and the expected testimony in a certain matter turned out to be other than was expected. Attell was held in New York for an extradition hearing. Sammy Pass, a Jew, was one of the witnesses. So was Johnny Says. The hearing resulted in New York refusing the extradition of Abe Attell. Then came the Dempsey-Carpentier fight in Jersey, which Abe Attell attended. Chicago officers were in attendance, too, with extradition papers signed by the governor of New Jersey. They intended to take Attell back with them, though without passing through New York. Attell attended the fight, but the underground wires, so active in this entire case, were working, and Attell eluded the Western officers. The next name in the roster will be that of Barney Dreyfus, a Jew, owner of the Pittsburgh National League Club. Mr. Dreyfus appeared in the public eye during the conduct of the grand jury inquiry into the shady games, with an insistent demand that the National Commission, the ruling body in baseball, of which Ban B. Johnson, is the acknowledged leader, should be abolished, and another plan, the Lasker Plan, substituted. It was intended to discredit the National Commission under cover of the rottenness that had been discovered between the Jew gamblers and the venial Chicago players. It was primarily an anti-Johnson move and nothing else, and it was led by a Jew whose principal followers were the rapidly increasing group of Jewish controllers of American baseball. What they have against Ban B. Johnson, impartial investigators have been unable to discover. Mr. Johnson's chief characteristic with reference to the Jewish side has been his implacable enmity to crookedness of any kind. That ought not to be a disqualification if baseball is to be saved. Yet the Jew-conceived, Jew-named, and Jew-advocated Lasker Plan won out.
Isn't that something? They went out. You know, I was thinking... I looked it up because I couldn't think of his name, but when it started out here talking about this Attell being the goat and saying that some men are so deep into the problem or the sin that they've been chosen to bear the sins of their friends on the promise that influence would be exerted, made me think of Cheney's aide, Lewis Scooter Libby. That's what he did, right? It was that kind of a thing, like, well... you know, somebody's, we've got to put somebody has to be sacrificed here. So it's going to be you, but we'll look after you. Don't worry. We'll get you out later. But what happened to
this? Sometimes they just
Libby, is he
caught,
still in prison?
Sometimes it's just that they got caught.
They get caught.
Because properly, Cheney should have been the fall guy for Libby, you know?
Yeah. Is Libby, is he still in prison? No, I'm sure he's not. He must have got out a long time ago.
I don't know. I don't remember all that stuff.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that doesn't remember.
I stopped paying close attention to politics after about 2004, 2005. I was interested in the invasion of Iraq. And I wrote about that, and then after that went down anyway, I just haven't been paying close attention to that stuff. You know, I already know that it's a disaster. It's just minor details working out now.
Right.
Okay. Karl Zork, the St. Louis Jew who was indicted, is variously described as a shirt maker and a silk broker. There are no variations, however, in his description as a gambler. He is part of the Jewish National Net of Gamblers, which acts nationally and makes killings on a national scale. It should be observed that the principal Jewish abuses are nationwide. This was shown in the United States government's investigation of the white slave traffic. The bootlegging business is nationwide. So is racetrack gambling. Baseball pools also are a national network for the catching of suckers. There is, therefore, nothing unusual that a shirt maker from St. Louis and a horse trader from East St. Louis and a bootlegger from Albany, together with clever high-ups and hopelessly declassed low-downs, should all be involved in a baseball scandal that breaks in Chicago. They are all really part of a national group.
You know, it mentions baseball pools. And then there's football pools, which might be even more popular, and other kind of things. And as I recall, back when I was around people, ordinary people more than I am now, that just about everybody got into these pools. I mean, you know, when there was a, you know, once it got to be like the World Series or something, everybody around was putting a little bit of money into these pools. And yet if people knew that at the head of all this stuff, although I don't know, maybe there's some that are just, you know, local pools, I don't know. But somebody starts. And then the person who wins gets the money. So there are healthy kind of local little wagering, I guess. It's not all going to
Some of them, you know, could be locally organized and straight up, but it doesn't mean that the game itself is straight up. Could be the game is crooked anyway.
Well, that's right. That's right, it is. They probably are.
Carl Zork, for example, staged the fight between Attell and a third-class boxer in which Attell welched in the sixth round in order to throw the fight because his friends had all bet on the third-rate man, getting tremendous odds. His friends would never have made the bet, or having made it, could never have won it without Attell's deliberate quitting and feigned whimpering. It was one of the rawest of many raw deals witnessed in Jew-controlled sports. But Attell is that kind of man. He is a servant for that kind of scheme. It was not by accident that Zork, the silk broker, and Attell, an ex-prize fighter, should be linked together in the baseball scandal. They had been linked in crooked work before. They are part of the national machinery organized and operated for the purpose of separating Gentile boobs from their money. If there were no Gentile boobs, or if the Gentile boob would only take a square look at the man behind the nationwide spider web, the gamblers and the Jewish sport purveyors would be in another kind of business, with perhaps less money to flaunt in the faces of honest people. If fans wish to know the trouble with American baseball, they have it in three words: too much Jew. Gentiles may rant out their parrot-like pro-Jewish propaganda, but the fact is that a sport is clean and helpful until it begins to attract Jewish investors and exploiters, and then it goes bad. The two facts have occurred in pairs too frequently and under too many dissimilar circumstances to have their relationship doubted.
Now, here they mention that the Gentiles come out with their parrot-like pro-Jewish propaganda. And so, you know, that was a problem then, just like now. And we often say, well, it's because of World War II and the Holocaust that this works on people. Well, it worked on the people before any of that took place. It seems like it's always worked. Well, you go back into certain times in Europe and so on, and people were wiser about it. But even then, they got taken advantage. You read through that stuff all the way back through the Middle Ages and before. Our people were being taken advantage by Jews, you know, all the time. And then they'd finally get mad or something and kick them out. Well, we can't even do that now. But yeah, you know, it's like we don't seem to. We're still stuck on this thing that you can't attack people as a whole race or group.
Yeah, well, we have this individualist ethos in the United States. You're supposed to judge people as individuals.
I know.
And that actually goes back to Christianity because, you know, Christians always hope for the redemption of the sinner.
Well, I don't know if individuality and the redemption of the sinner is exactly the same, you know, thing. But it comes from a lot of places, because there's always that idea. Sure, you know, I'm sure you can find that in Greek classics and so on too. Having that, you know, there's this idea that it's individuals are corrupted, and of all kinds. So, well, I don't know.
When you contrast the grandstands full of Americans supposing they are witnessing the only clean sport with the sinister groups playing with the players and the managers to introduce a serpent's trail of unnecessary crookedness, you get a contrast that is rather startling. And the sinister influence is Jewish. So patent was this that even newspapers could not cover this fact this time. Could not cover the facts this time. Years before this scandal broke, involving a whole team, it was noticed that certain Jewish gamblers formed the habit of rooming with certain baseball players. It worried the managers. The fact that the gamblers coddled in among the players was fraught with a suggestion of disturbing unusualness. Managers tried the experiment of trading such players, getting them out of their teams as quickly as possible. However, the snuggling game was continued until it honeycombed the whole of baseball, with the result that it was with no trepidation at all that the Jewish gamblers could walk up and suggest to players that a game be thrown for a price. The occurrence which formed the basis of the investigation was not the first of the kind, far from it. The approach of the gamblers was too easy. The reception given them by the players was too casual to warrant that view. Nor were the men whose names were given to the public the only men involved. The only fact of value brought out of all the trouble is that American baseball has passed into the hands of the Jews. If it is to be saved, it must be taken out of their hands until they have shown themselves capable of promoting sports for sport's sake.
Hmm.
Yeah, we're going to give them a second chance.
Right? Yeah, well, we're not. I thought about that too, but I thought, you know, they're just saying that because it sounds, you know, sounds fair, but they know that, if, you know, they'll never show themselves capable of that.
Seriously, so grow up a little bit, then you can have some responsibilities.
Well, you know, if they could do that, yeah, but they'll never do it. So that means it would never be taken back. But another thing before you end here is that, you know, this is a great statement. American baseball has passed into the hands of the Jews. Well, we can substitute anything else with that for that too. The American government now has passed into the hands of the Jews. Correct? And it must be taken out of their hands. That's just what it comes down to. You know, and it's more important than baseball.
Well, real power in the USA is in mass media.
Well, that's the Jews.
Yes, that's my point. Actually, they don't entirely control the government.
Oh, I see.
They control the mass media, which in turn influences the government.
Yeah, well, you know, they control a whole lot more than the mass media.
If it is not taken out of their hands, let it be widely announced that baseball is another Jewish monopoly and that its patrons may know what to expect.
Yep.
All right, that's the end of chapter 45. And now chapter 46 of The International Jew, Jewish Degradation of American Baseball. Every non-Jewish baseball manager in the United States lives between two fears, and they are both describable in biblical terms, the fear of the Jews. That's from the John Gospel. The first fear concerns what the Jews are doing to baseball. The second fear concerns what the Jew would do to the manager if he complained about it. Hence, in spite of the fact that the rowdyism that has afflicted baseball, especially in the East, is all of Jewish origin, the razzing of umpires, hurling of bottles, ceaseless shouting of profane insults. In spite of the fact that the loyalty of players had to be constantly guarded because of the tendency of individual Jewish gamblers to snuggle up to individual players, in spite of the evidence that even the gate receipts have been tampered with, the managers and secretaries of baseball clubs have been obliged to keep their mouths closed. Through fear, they have not dared say what they know. As one manager said, "Good God, man, they'd boycott my park if I told you." This in free America and in the cleanest game. It is time for baseball fans to begin to look around. Incidentally, the fans have been looking around. The fans know. If managers only knew how much the fans have observed, they might feel more certain of support in the event of a move toward a cleanup. All that a Jew needs to make him eligible to baseball or any other sport on the same terms with other people is to develop a sportsman's spirit. The Jew has crowded into all the lucrative sports, but only on the commercial side of them. Seldom, if ever, in sympathy with the sport as a real sportsman. The Jews referred to as gamblers in these articles are not really gamblers. They take no chances. They are not sportsmen enough to gamble. They are sure thing men. The Gentile boobs who walk into their traps are the people who provide the money. Even in the field of money, the Jew is not a sport. He is a gangster, ringing a gang of his ilk around his victims with as much system as a storekeeper supplies clerks and delivery boys. Lately, the Jews have been endeavoring to prove that they are sports. Venial sports editors are sometimes induced to write certain laudatory articles along that line, and frequently the name of Benny Leonard is used. Benny Leonard, the lightweight fighter. Benny forms an instructive illustration just along this line. Benny declares that he went into the ring without a scar and that he will leave the ring without a scar. Why? because he will let no one hit him. He will go a long way to avoid pain. The true wrestler risks and often suffers physical pain. So does the true ring fighter. But it is a Jewish characteristic to avoid, if possible, the pain of contest, just as it is a characteristic to avoid unnecessary effort. Look at the other lightweight champions and fighters. Kid Lavinge carries scars. His hearing is affected by the blows he took. Battling Nelson was so badly shattered by his fights that operations were necessary. Add Wolgast, as a result of the honest, straight fighting he endured, went into a sanatorium. Imagine Willie Ritchie and Freddie Welsh boasting that they had never took a blow. But Benny Leonard is still unscarred. It may be boxing, but it is not fighting. Wrestling is so tightly controlled by Jewish managers that a real wrestler is absolutely barred out for fear he will be able to show that the handful of wrestlers hired by the Jewish Trust are not wrestlers at all, but only impositions on the good nature of the public. In order that the statement just made may not be misunderstood, it is repeated. The wrestling game at present is like the chariot race in a circus. The performers are hired men, and the race is only a sham. The Jewish controllers of wrestling will not permit a real wrestler to appear. Indeed, they go to infinite pains to bar him out, because a real wrestler would immediately show up the game. Wrestling is as much a Jewish business, controlled in its every part, as the manufacture of clothing, and its hirelings are mostly Gentiles. That is what baseball was coming to. The whole sport was getting down to an exhibition game status. The overtone of money, money, money grew louder and louder. The sport aspect of the game was beginning to give way to the show aspect. There were numerous signs that an attempt was being made to star certain persons, to run headliners, and to pull off a game with a sensational ending, just like a ballet is staged or a pageant. Thrills were being offered, not as the give and take of the game, the accident of tensest action, but as practiced acting.
You know, this whole idea here of the exhibition games and the show aspect of it, and I was saying earlier that baseball was, you could substitute government, saying the government's been taken over by the Jews too. And now we're having, I know you don't see it this way, but we're having all these events, you know, that a lot of people are calling psyops and staged events, and you know, that by the government and spy agencies, intelligence agencies, and so on. So that, you know, in that sense, with the Jews behind everything, our entire world, our world of serious events is also becoming show business. You know, I think that's a very valid point that could be, you know, should be considered. That everything is just, you know, will becoming a show. And that goes to not just today, and but to Orwell's book, 1984. Where, you know, things are so managed, and, you know, those wars were managed and so on, and, you know, they just kept having something that was being managed. It wasn't really real, but people thought it was. It's just, you know, this is the Jewish way to do it, because they want to be in control of everything so tightly. So they, you know, it makes sense that they would prefer that to just letting things happen. Anyway, I thought I'd throw that in there.
Well, in the case of an organized sporting event, it's easy enough to see how the outcome could be rigged.
Well, sure, it's different. It's a bigger thing, but I think they still have a lot of potential ability for doing that other, because we don't know, you know, what all this, what all the technology they have and so on. It's something to think about.
Okay. That is, baseball was slowly being brought under the level of the box office idea. There were forces against this metamorphosis of the game. Certain men saw what was coming. There were also forces favoring the change and wanting it to come. Curiously enough, the forces that favored turning baseball into afternoon vaudeville were Jews. And those who favored keeping the game as part of American outdoor sports were non-Jews. There were more involved in that Chicago trial, that curious medley of Jewish defendants, witnesses, lawyers, and judge, than the mere trial of baseball players accused of unlawfully taking money. The players were the Gentile boobs. The players were not a whit different than a candidate for the United States Senate who plays the game according to the Jewish method. Every player on trial was there because he had listened to the suggestions of a Jew. The Jews who made the suggestions were not on trial. Some of them were not even indicted. Some who were called before the grand jury were not required to testify. Others who were indicted were acquitted. The spotlight of the whole scandal was centered on the non-Jewish players who were pushed out in front to do the job, and who were known to any number of Jewish witnesses as having been mixed up in whatever shady work there may have been. The Gentile boobs had no witnesses. The Jews had all of them. This is not a whitewash for the players. They deserved all they got for mixing up with the low hangers-on. But they did not deserve it alone. Had they been half men, there would have been a few Jewish gamblers cured for life of the little habit of approaching ball players with a shady proposition. The players are Jewish dupes. To be such a dupe is punishment enough. It would be erroneous, however, to hold the opinion that corruption in baseball began with the matter which was aired in court. Reference was made at the beginning of this article to the fear which the managers feel. This fear is of long standing. The managers had observed certain manifestations of evil years before. They had heard rumors which they did not repeat to their closest friends. They had started quiet investigations, the results of which they did not reveal even to their partners in the clubs. Everybody acquainted with the true situation lived in deathly fear of emitting a whisper that might give a clue to the truth. But the truth is stronger than walls and doors and steel vaults. The truth was known at every stage of the game by somebody. Fans may recall that several years ago, one of the Eastern teams began to get rid of most of its men. It was a strange proceeding and occasioned much discussion. The sports pages speculated about it, and the wise ones doped out plausible or fantastic explanations. The true explanation has never yet been given, and it is this. The manager of that club had seen certain things in the World Series of that year which turned him cold. He knew that he saw them. Morally, he was convinced that something was wrong. He exhausted every available method to get at the truth and failed. So, unable to bring the men to public punishment, he simply got rid of them one by one. And the next season, he had practically rebuilt his team. That was not more than 10 and not less than 5 years before the 1919 World Series, which formed the basis of the Chicago scandal. It may be stated also that this which follows is the consensus of Jewish opinion as regards baseball. You can't kill baseball as a business. It will always drag He will always draw a gang on an afternoon, particularly a Sunday afternoon. It can be pepped up and jazzed up in a way that will make it quite a show. The Jews are probably right that baseball cannot be killed as a business, but it can be killed as a sport. And the American baseball fans who value the game as a sport should wish its utter destruction rather than consent that it become a rendezvous for the gangs that now fill the Jew-controlled burlesque houses. Baseball as a business will become a danger in American life, a mob center, a hangout of the disorderly and criminal classes. There is another peculiar Jewish story regarding baseball, which has not been told, and it necessarily brings in the name of Judge Landis of Chicago, an upright man with a wise head, whom the Jews would better not try to fool. When the story is told, however, even the Jews will agree that Judge Landis is too shrewd for them. Before the baseball scandal, the situation was this. Ban Johnson was the head of organized baseball through the National Commission. He had brought the sport from a minor place to its position as the national game. Ban Johnson was something of an autocrat, as all leaders must be, because, as old General William Booth of the Salvation Army said, "If the children of Israel had been managed by a committee, they never would have crossed the Red Sea." He was the founder of the Salvation Army. He was from England, actually. Autocracy has its uses, especially in striking out new lines. Ban Johnson used his power for baseball, not for personal aggrandizement. He saw the game grow great. He wanted it kept clean. In his efforts to keep it clean, he made certain enemies. One of those enemies, the Jewish owner of a baseball club, threatened to get Johnson. As far as the National Commission, as the head of organized baseball, is concerned, they did get him. But so far as his prestige is concerned, they did not get him. Judge Landis was a fan. That is, he was a fan. Besides being a learned and rather strict judge, Judge Landis was one of the few judges who did not quail before Chicago meat packers and Jewish bootleggers. Judge Landis always went the limit on the numerous cases of Jewish business crookedness that came before him. Blue sky investment companies and the like. He was at least one judge who tried Jew and Gentile alike, and whose impartiality and fearless righteousness no one doubted. Judge Landis was a rather uncomfortable man to have on the bench in Chicago. Moreover, he was a comparatively poor man. The United States pays its judges only $7,500 a year. That is less than $150 a week. Comparatively little on which to live as a federal judge must live. Yet Judge Landis lived in a modest house and within his income, and no one ever dared tamper with him. An honest judge on the bench, a frugal man outside, and he was a fan. Now, while Ben Johnson was doing his best for baseball, and while Judge Landis was seeing a game as often as his duties permitted, certain others were viewing the situation. One of them was Alfred S. Austrian, the Jewish lawyer referred to in the last article, attorney for several ball clubs, friend of Riplogle and Lasker, attorney for Rothstein, the gambler, and several others. Barney Dreyfus, the Jewish owner of the Pittsburgh club, was on the trail of Johnson on persistent enmity. The Jewish coterie in Chicago and the Jewish influence throughout American baseball looked at Johnson, and they looked at Judge Landis. Then the great idea broke. If at one stroke they could rid baseball of Johnson and rid the bench of Landis, what a good job that would be. Both these men were dangerous to Jews, not that they intended to be, not that they were consciously so, and it would be desirable to remove both from the spheres of their activity. Then it was that the Jew lawyer, Austrian, came forth with the Lasker Plan, named for his Jewish friend Lasker, member of the American Jewish Committee, head of Lord and Thomas, Gentile names, and chairman of the United States Shipping Board. The Lasker Plan proposed that the National Commission with Ban Johnson be superseded by a one-man government, that one man to be selected from outside both leagues. The proposal was not an immediate success. Even the National League was in no hurry to obey this suggestion against Johnson. Indeed, there was so much hesitancy on the part of the Nationals, in which the Jewish colleagues expected to find their best support, that the trump card was played. What was that trump card? It is said to be the secret testimony of the grand jury before which Ban Johnson was glad to appear as a witness to tell the jury everything it would need for a proper prosecution of its inquiry, and before which Alfred S. Austrian also appeared to save some of his clients from the consequences of such testimony. The report is that Austrian was able to reproduce at the National League meeting the secret testimony which Ban Johnson had given before the grand jury, and by that means swing the Nationals against Johnson and in favor of the Lasker Plan. Because in the grand jury room, Johnson told the truth about certain elements in baseball, which was held to reflect on National League members. What those elements are may be gathered from a survey of the people who were interested in getting Johnson. Johnson is anything but anti-Semitic. He probably has never stopped to think about such a thing. He has never been known to attack Jews as Jews. But he has stood for straight baseball, and for so standing, he has won the enmity of Jews in baseball. These facts are sufficient to justify a conclusion. So, with Johnson left to head only the American League and not both leagues, the next task was to select the new autocrat of baseball. Not a commission this time, but one man. With all his power, Johnson was never more than one of a commission, but the Lasker Plan disposes of such safeguards and leaves the whole authority on one man's hands. It will be interesting to see who becomes the second incumbent of that office, if indeed the Lasker Plan lasts long enough to warrant a second autocrat. Gentle reader, do you suppose for a moment that the Jews who opposed Johnson did not know who the new leader would be? Ah, well, they knew. He was to be a man outside both leagues. And he was to be a man whom the Jews would just as soon have off the bench as on it. He was indeed none other than Judge Landis, who can be trusted to see through a trick as far as any other living man. Of course he would accept. Of course he would accept a $42,500 job. He who was receiving only $7,500 a year. And of course he would resign from the bench. Thus the coterie reasoned. They trooped over to the court to interview the judge. They made so much commotion on their entry that the gavel was banged for order. The interview was held. Judge Landis agreed to accept. This news was widely heralded. The judge tied them down to a 7-year contract. It was assumed in all the interviews, in all the newspapers, that the judge would resign from the bench. It was assumed he would devote the rest of his life to baseball. The baseball magnates signed up under the Lasker plan put across by Austrian. Judge Landis also signed, and then he remained on the bench. The reader no doubt remembers how quickly enthusiasm for Judge Landis died down in certain quarters. Remembers, too, no doubt, that a fight was started immediately afterwards in the United States Congress to force Judge Landis off the bench. Not to make him give up the dictatorship of baseball, but to make him quit the bench. And be this said, in spite of all the collusion and conspiracy and trickery of which Judge Landis was the unconscious object, baseball fell into the hands of a man who will be just as jealous for its good name as Ben Johnson was. The Austrian Lasker-Dreyfus plan has so far failed, and Judge Landis has rendered several decisions which show that on the bench or off the bench, he has the same shrewd eye for the detection of a fallacy. Judge Landis is safeguarded by a 7-year contract. He is free to be absolutely fearless and fair. What his accession means to baseball will be anxiously awaited. Judge Landis is probably not empowered to stop the steady falling of baseball clubs into Jewish hands. And if this cannot be stopped, his position as supreme dictator becomes little better than that of a police court judge settling disputes relating to the rules and offenses against them. The peril of baseball goes deeper than that. A few years ago, the owners of the American League entered into a gentleman's agreement not to sell their holdings at any time without first consulting all the other owners. The name of a prospective purchaser was to be submitted and considered, and the deal was to wait upon the approval of all the owners in the league. In the face of that fact, many people wonder how Harry Frazee became owner of the Boston American Club. It is very simply explained. The agreement was not observed in Boston's case, and thus another club was placed under the smothering influences of the chosen race. The story is worth telling. Frazee, like so many of his kind, was in the show business, a manager of burlesque companies. Then he saw a chance in sport. In partnership with Jack Curley, another Jew, he put on the notoriously crooked fight between Jack Johnson and Jess Willard in Havana. Curley has been the principal influence in killing wrestling by precisely the kind of Jewish policy here described. Jack Johnson, the Negro, was a fugitive from justice, yet he was champion prize fighter of the world. He was spending money like a wild sailor, or you could say like a Negro, and his funds were running low. He was getting into precisely the condition where Jews like to find a man to use him. Unable to fight in the United States, but still possessing the championship, he was in need of a way out. At this time, Frazee and Curley made a proposition to Johnson, said to involve the sum of $35,000 if he would lay down before Jess Willard. And thus, Jess Willard, probably the worst fighter that ever held a title, was made world champion. Frazee and Curley then exhibited Willard on the stage and in circuses and drew rich dividends. The crooked fight at Havana did not involve Willard. He was too poor a fighter to need fixing. Only Johnson had to be fixed, not to knock out Willard. which he could easily have done. But between the time when Curly and Frazee gave Willard the title and the time when Dempsey took it away from him, the Jewish syndicate made a very rich killing out of the gullible American public. But Curly is not the subject here. He deserves a separate story. Frazee concerns this article because he became owner of the Boston baseball team. He bought a new show, the Boston Club, in the best baseball city of the American League. John J. Lannan, former owner, John J. Lannan, former owner, was a real baseball man. So much so inclined, indeed, that the excitement of the games told on his health, and it became necessary for him to relieve himself of the strain. Frazee was waiting to cut in, and whether Lannan feared that the proposal of Frazee's name to the American League would result in disapproval, or whether Frazee himself, knowing it, contrived to make it worthwhile that the agreement between the American League owners should be ignored, remains an open question. However that may be, the American League woke up one morning to find the little burlesque manager and promoter of a crooked prize fight in their midst. It was a sad shock to the dignity of the cleanest sport. What could they do about it? Nothing. Frazee had bought and paid for what he held. Baseball was about as much of a sport to Frazee as selling tickets to a merry-go-round would be. He wanted to put his team across as if they were Mae Watson's girly, girly burlesquers. Baseball was to be promoted as Jewish managers promote Coney Island. The American League owners rebelled, but let them rebel. What could they do about it? Frazee began his next inside work almost immediately. Ben Johnson was unalterably opposed to the Frazee idea of sport. And Frazee set out to get Johnson. A split occurred in the American League with Frazee, Till Houston, and Jack Rupert of the New York Club, and Charles A. Comiskey and Grabener of the Chicago Club on one side against Johnson, and the other American owners comprising the other party supporting Johnson. Frazee got money out of Chicago, the home of Lasker, Austrian, Replogle, and Grabener, to put through his Boston deal. A bank loaned him $250,000. One of Frazee's friends was a director of the bank. Frazee's friend died, and Frazee had difficulty with the bank about remaking the notes. He finally was enabled to pay $125,000. Frazee secured this money from the New York American Club by selling Babe Ruth. Thus, the New York and the Boston clubs have become financially interwoven. Boston is referred to as New York's farm in baseball circles. In the meantime, the fans of Boston feel toward Frazee as the fans of Chicago feel toward Grabener. The class of Boston no longer flows through the gates. The attendance at Boston Park is smaller than at any other time in the last 15 years. Now, it is unlikely that Judge Landis could tackle that question. He has power, has he power or lacking power, has he daring enough to assume power to drive the peril away from the ownership and fringes of baseball? It is probably not his field, but it pertains to the future character of baseball. The Chicago American League Club is the most recent to attract the desire of Jewish capital. The Asher brothers of that city have offered $1,500,000 for the club franchise. The Asher brothers comprise a Jewish family, Max, Nathan, and Harry, who conduct a string of motion picture theaters in Chicago. They have erected their own theatrical circuit. Like Frazee, they wish to add baseball to their string of show businesses and are willing to pay the price. At the time of this writing, their offer has not been turned down. But a significant development, and in Chicago also, is the announcements made by the Chicago Tribune that it will curtail the space heretofore devoted to baseball on its sports pages. This, more than anything which has occurred, indicates the new scrutiny with which the game is being viewed. For a long time, many observers have wondered where the sport was found in sitting on a bleacher watching a few men earn their salaries. Hours thus spent in a ballpark do not take anything off the waistline of the spectators, nor add anything to chest measurement, says the Tribune. The majority of spectators get only eye and mouth exercise. Journalism has overfed it with space, the Tribune rightly says, referring to professional baseball. In ruining baseball and securing control, the Jews may be just in time to take a loss. Better no baseball than every park and afternoon midway filled with the alien and red elements of the country. There is, however, a baseball duty devolving upon the police of every city, and that is the abolition of the Jew-controlled baseball pool. Gambling has grown up around the cleanest game to the extent of $20 million a year. It flourishes in 150 cities in the country and in many small towns. The boobs, of course, are mostly non-Jews. The owners and profit-takers are Jews. It is as much a part of the national network of the Jewish gambling fraternity as are booze running and horse racing. The baseball pool runs more openly than the books because the very name baseball has seemed to give it the protection of the cleanest sport. However, it has turned cigar stores, barbershops, pool rooms, near beer saloons, and newspaper stands into agencies for the national and international Jewish gambling forces. The bettor is entirely at the mercy of the managers of these pools. These dishonest money-collecting devices are in violation of the law everywhere. The police could put them out of business easily if they should decide to give their attention to it. And thereby they would be taking the hands of a most undesirable alien class out of the pockets of the American people.
Most undesirable alien class. Oh, funny.
If baseball is to be saved, and there are those who seriously doubt it ever can be restored, the remedy is plain. The disease is caused by the Jewish characteristic which spoils everything by ruthless commercial exploitation. The disease may be too far gone for any cure. There are those who, like the Chicago Tribune, deny that professional baseball ever was a sport, and who are glad that Jewish exploiters like scavengers have come along to reduce it to garbage. But there is no doubt anywhere, among either friends or critics of baseball, that the root cause of the present condition is due to Jewish influence.
Excellent job, Hadding. You got it all in. I can hardly believe it, and I'm so glad we have completed these two baseball chapters now. This was on the 10th of September, 1921, and next week, ladies and gentlemen, we will begin a new chapter, so be sure to be with us then. We'll see you later. Good night.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.